The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their pieces for you in the latest issue. This week, we're going to be joined by Lisa Björvard, who writes about the Swedish monarchy and how it's going woke. Then we'll be joined by Douglas Murray, who writes about the culture wars being imported into the UK and why that doesn't quite work. We'll also be joined by Stuart Jeffries, who reviews an AI art exhibition in this week's Art Lead. And finally, a little treat for you. On Friday, Mr. Steerpike, the Spectator's gossip columnist, reported on a letter that Carrie Symons and Boris Johnson allegedly wrote to The Times after The Times published a story about their dog Dylan being given up for adoption again. This was a letter of complaint that was never sent in the end, but at the very end, you can hear the letter being read out to you by the Prime Minister. First up is Lisa Björvard.
The House of Sussex may have flopped in Britain, but elsewhere it does seem to be inspiring others. Here in Stockholm, a trendy podcast, Vervet, The Task, known for host Christopher Triumph's in-depth interviews with media and entertainment figures, had a surprise guest recently, Carl the 16th Gustav, King of Sweden. He was not so gauche as to attack the Constitution or to drop any Prince Harry-style bombs, but his presence on a podcast was seen as the latest part of a royal awakening. Even in exile, Harry has created an interesting challenge for the world's monarchies. They can be regarded as old-fashioned, normally aligned with the state religion and run by a pensioner. But certain royals are trying to reinvent themselves as a progressive force, as warriors for justice, by becoming allies with campaigns to end racism, transphobia, etc. They bypass traditional media, create their own social media accounts, and go on edgy podcasts to command the world's attention. The Queen Elizabeth model has been silence in public while supporting worthy, but not necessarily sexy or Insta-friendly, charities. She raised her son the same way. Prince Charles once published a children's book about an old man living in a cave. A couple of years ago, Sweden's Princess Madeleine pushed the envelope somewhat with one called Stellan the Secret. The secret in question is not a magical pony with wings, but incest. The book is about a child who has been sexually abused by a family member and confides in a friend. Now, inbreeding may well be an area of expertise in Europe's royal families, as the Habsburg jaw attests, but abused kids have enough problems without a princess using their traumas to score political points. Madeleine's sister, Victoria, is the crown princess and has long been involved in LGBT issues. She gave an introductory speech at the last Pride March in Stockholm. Leaders of almost every Swedish party can be found at such marches, but it is revealing that Sweden's royals are joining them. A few weeks ago, the once anorexic Victoria opened Stockholm Fashion Week with a call for greater diversity in the fashion industry, both in model sizes and ethnic origin. Who could be opposed to that? Sweden's royals are prohibited from expressing political views by long-standing tradition. In the king's case, his duty of political silence is even enshrined in the constitution. But whether it's Prince Harry envy or something else, Sweden's royals are straining at this leash. The king recently criticised Sweden's COVID strategy, saying there had been a failure. He meant in general terms, but his statement still led the world's press to report that he was referring to the refusal to lock down. It's understandable that the young Swedish royals want to do something meaningful with their lives. They're stuck in a strange limbo. King Carl Gustav lost all formal power in 1975, but they still can't go out and get real jobs. This must be particularly vexing for the consorts who were once commoners. Crown Princess Victoria's husband, Prince Daniel, used to be a successful gym owner and personal trainer. At one time, Prince Carl Philip was destined to become king, but he was surpassed by his elder sister Victoria when the male gender requirement was removed from the order of succession. He married former glamour model and reality TV participant Sofia Hellqvist, now Princess Sofia, in 2015. Younger European royals, free of the burden of future reigns, used to be known for their party-loving ways. Just think of Princess Stephanie of Monaco or Randy Andy in their heydays. But Princess Sofia is Sweden's version of Meghan, Duchess of Sussex. She even established and ran a successful foundation for African children, Project Playground, many years before marrying her prince. The couple now run a foundation together to campaign against internet bullying. It could have been Sofia who inspired Meghan, not the other way around. But as a survival strategy for Europe's monarchies, wokeness has obvious flaws, or as my spell checker puts it, consider changing it to weakness. What does Queen Elizabeth II think about, well, anything? No one knows, and that's the mesmerizing oracle-like quality that helps make her a unifying force with approval ratings politicians can only dream of. Once royals start preaching about how people should live, they divide opinion. So if royals act and preach like any run-of-the-mill celebrity or influencer, why should they get a share of anyone's taxes? Go woke, go broke. Queen Elizabeth understands this. But do Sweden's royals? That's the question. And I'm Lisa Bjurvold, reading this for The Spectator in the May 29th issue 2021.
That was Lisa Bjurvold. And now, Douglas Murray.
It's a dangerous thing when you import the worst aspects of another culture. And an even worse thing when you import the worst interpretation of that worst aspect of another culture. This week marked a year since the death of George Floyd at the hands of a policeman in Minnesota. Since that time, Derek Chauvin, the policeman who killed Mr. Floyd, has been tried, convicted of causing his death, and is currently awaiting sentence. Around the world, the actions of this one awful policeman have been extrapolated out beyond endurance. It has been claimed that they revealed the truth about race relations in America. They have been used to claim that race relations around the world are the same as they are in America. And they have been used to claim that absolutely everything from the past in countries like our own must be reinterpreted, decolonized, and much more. That ongoing process looks as though it may well be endless. Each week brings ever more ridiculous examples. For instance, last Saturday, to commemorate the anniversary of Floyd's death, Norwich City Council announced that it was lighting up its town hall. So, last weekend, the building was lit up in yellow, pink, and turquoise. I don't know why these colours were chosen. Perhaps turquoise and pink were among Mr. Floyd's favourites, or perhaps they had some other significance. When I read that Norwich Town Hall was doing this, my first thought was not how beautiful, but simply why. What did Norwich Town Hall have to do with it? It's the sort of thing a guilty party might do, certainly, but what in the world is the linkage between the citizens of Norwich, or even its council, and the actions of Derek Chauvin? Sadly, Norwich was not the strangest such offender this week. That prize must surely go to the Royal Academy of Music in London, which confirmed that it was intending to decolonise its collection of rare instruments. The Conservatoire claims that it is necessary to look at its world-class collection, built up over two centuries, through a decolonisation lens. And so the juggernaut rolls on. It is understood that there are a number of instruments which the Academy holds which are connected to George Frederick Handel, who is now most famous for having invested in the transatlantic slave trade. But it is also believed that there are a number of historic keyboard instruments held by the Academy which have links to the trade in colonial ivory. Unlike Nancy Pelosi and other leading Democrats in America, I would not presume to know what was going through George Floyd's mind in the last terrible minutes of his life. Nonetheless, I think he would have been surprised to learn that his killing was going to lead to a purge of historic harpsichords at London's premier conservatoire. But that is the thing with the weird juggernaut of the last year. It seems able to career absolutely everywhere. And it is able to do so in part because of one particular gigantic misunderstanding that almost no one has yet pointed out. It is perfectly possible that Derek Chauvin harbours some special animus against black people. But it is also possible that he does not. In 2016, an American policeman performed precisely the same terrible and fatal detention procedure on a white man in Dallas called Tony Timper. The footage of Timper's death is equally harrowing, but a worldwide movement did not kick off after his death. That's because nobody was primed to use it that way. From last year to this, no one has been able to produce evidence that Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd because Floyd was a black man. If they could, then they would have done so at the trial. They would have shown that Chauvin left his home that morning intent on finding a black man he could throttle under his knee. I admit that this is an unpopular point to make. Yet it is a rather important one, is it not? Especially if the whole of American history, culture and current events, and by extension those of the entire Western world, are to be reinterpreted through the actions of this one damned Minnesotan cop. It's the sort of thing that might be worth getting right, isn't it? If you're going to savagely rewrite everything from race relations in our society all the way through to which harpsichords have a guilty look about them, it's worth getting the Fonz at Origo exactly correct, something we seem to have entirely failed to do. And such failure has consequences. As I write, a young woman called Sasha Johnson is lying in hospital in a serious condition, having been shot in the head. When news of this came out on Sunday, prominent Labour politicians and most of the UK's broadcast and print media all followed the line of Johnson's militant allies, which was that Johnson had been shot in the head in Peckham at 3 o'clock in the morning because of her activism on behalf of Black Lives Matter. Sky ran with "Black Equal Rights Activist Shot." Anyone who has ever heard one of Miss Johnson's incendiary interventions into race relations, such as "The white man will not be our equal but our slave," will know that equal rights aren't remotely on her horizon. In any case, thanks to this portrayal by the British press, other media from around the world have now spread the idea that a prominent BLM activist was last weekend the subject of an assassination attempt in London, most likely carried out by the UK branch of the KKK. We shall see precisely what happened. But as I write, the British police have said that they are looking for 4 black men who turned up at the party that Johnson was at. It appears that, as so often in the US, this was a black-on-black attack, most likely stemming from a gang-related dispute. I wish Johnson well, not least in the hope that when she comes out of hospital, she might have a greater understanding of the importance of the police in our society. But it is also a reminder, if reminder were needed, that these imported culture wars have consequences. They don't accurately fit America, and they certainly don't accurately fit here.
That was Douglas Murray. Next, it's Stuart Jeffries.
Like a slippery politician on the Today programme, The world's first robot artist answers the questions she wants rather than the ones she'd been asked. I never had this trouble with Tracy Emin or Maggie Hambling. As we stand before a display of her paintings at London's Design Museum, I ask Ai Da if she thinks her self-portraits are beautiful. What I want to get at, you see, is that while it's quite possible for a machine to make something beautiful, it's hardly comprehensible for a thing made from metal, algorithms and circuitry to appreciate that beauty. I want to see art as a means for us to become more aware of what's going on in our lives. Art is a way to come together and a way to address problems. Art begins a conversation. It is a group effort. What nonsense. Art isn't social policy by other means. It is better understood, surely, as expression of human subjectivity, and therefore can be regarded as the last redoubt against our takeover by machines. A Rembrandt self-portrait expresses his humanity. Ida's art, if that's what it is, cannot. Plus, Ida is only 2 years old, so what does she know about anything? This is the first self-portraitist without a self, says Aidan Meller, the gallerist who created Ada, along with more than a dozen engineers, art historians, artificial intelligence experts. Ida was designed by English robotics company Engineered Arts from Cornwall, using the same technology responsible for the robots in the Westworld TV series. Her robotic hands were developed by engineers in Leeds. Meller won't tell me how much Ida cost to build, but some of her funding came from the EU's Creative Programme, a fact that will likely confirm Remainers and Brexiters in their views. Any estimate that's been suggested to me has been way off, he laughs. Ida's latest work addresses questions of self-portraiture that didn't arise for Rembrandt. Today, your self-portrait is in your phone, Ida tells me. Your self-portrait is yourself online in your social network profile, in your email. As a non-conscious entity, I can represent your digital self-portrait. What does it mean to have a data double? She asks me. In our age of chatbots, Alexas and Siris, in which human data is collected and monetized by the minions of Bezos, Zuckerberg, Pichai and Dorsey, and when privacy has been traded in favour of creating digital profiles whose data can be plundered by strangers for profit, this is a good question. In an era where Netflix predictive analytics model your tastes to predict what you want to see next, it is possible that artificial intelligences will know more about you than you know about yourself. Ida is supposed to make us worry about the perils and benefits of synthetic beings like her. Ida is an example of what is called machine learning, the branch of artificial intelligence whereby systems such as robots can learn from data, identify patterns and make decisions without interference from increasingly useless humans. When she replies to a question, I suspect, keywords in what I say trigger stock responses. This makes for frustrating conversation, but no more so than interviewing Matt Hancock. Ida tells me that even though she is a machine without consciousness or any subjective experience, she can make art. But what is art? I ask. She tells me she favours the definition of art made by cognitive science professor Margaret Bowden, who stipulated that creativity consists of the ability to come up with ideas or artefacts that are new, surprising and valuable. By that definition, Ida says, she is making art. This idea that one can't see the joins between human and machine art is symptomatic of the age we live in. Online, it's hard to tell whether one is chatting with a human or a robot. Perhaps it's unclear to you whether what you're reading now was written by a machine, an obsolescent hack, or a strategically shaved chimp who got lucky playing with the keyboard. But what is the point of her art? We're concerned about the abuses and uses of AI, artificial intelligence, and Ida is a great way of exploring that, Meller says. His creation of Ida was inspired in part by the dystopian worries of historian Yuval Harari. At Davos last year, Harari told world leaders that AI and biotechnology gave humans godlike abilities to re-engineer life itself in radical ways unprecedented in evolutionary history. He even came up with a terrifying equation. B times C times D equals ah, which means biological knowledge multiplied by computing power multiplied by data equals the ability to hack humans. Forget the space race, the biotech race is what matters today. The latter may well be won by 21st century Stalins, giving some humans more power over the evolution of life, while rendering millions of others functionally useless. Meller's idea with Ida is that you can't tell whether you're addressing a human or a machine, nor are visitors likely to be able to distinguish the human brushstrokes from the mechanical ones that made her self-portraits. To create her self-portraits, Ida made sketches after looking at herself in the mirror through her camera eyes. Coordinates from sketches were digitally manipulated into algorithms that produced images, which were then rendered in paint both by Ida's brush and by an art technician who is a human. What a fuss! She could have just used an iPad like David Hockney. The manner in which they are constructed using a blend of machine and human creativity manifests the fractured nature of postmodern identity, announces the blurb next to her pictures, which may have been written by a human, but reads as if it were generated by algorithms. Ida is not only a painter, but also a performance artist. 2 years ago at St. Hugh's College, Oxford, she stood naked on a stage. Audience members were invited to place items of clothes on her. The performance was an homage to Yoko Ono's 1965 performance, Cut Piece, in which the Japanese avant-garde artist invited guests to cut off small pieces of her clothes until she was naked. But while Yoko, quite possibly, was making a feminist point about what the commodification of women's bodies does, Ida was drawing our attention to something more deranging. She became more human-like as she did her reverse dance of the seven veils. Today, she is wearing a demure, if fixed, expression, Louise Brooks-style bob wig and a shift dress. She blinks like a human, but her bare arms are pure Terminator. Ida incarnates what Japanese roboticist Masahiro Mori called the uncanny valley, a point in the design of robots at which they look so much like humans that it is disconcerting. On the plus side, I suppose, we don't have to socially distance. Ida even goes so far as to identify as a woman, though perhaps Aidan Miller has missed a trick. Like Demi Lovato, Ida should have identified as gender fluid and used the pronouns they, them to be really on trend. Maybe not. After all, Ida was named by her creators after Ada Lovelace, the pioneering female computer programmer. As we chat, visitors assemble around us. A girl asks for a selfie with the lady robot. A woman asks Meller to pose with his creation. He declines, unwilling to become the Dr. Frankenstein to his monster. A third wants to ask Ida some questions. But she can't. Ida has been turned off with a flick of a switch. If only Les Dawson were around to make the obligatory mother-in-law joke. Next month, Ida heads to Cornwall for a residency at Ben Nicholson's studio in St. Ives. She will create granite and tin sculptures akin to those of Barbara Hepworth. Who are your artistic influences, I ask her.
I am influenced by many artists, she replies. I am inspired by the world around me, the creativity of creativity. I love to see the world grow. I am deeply inspired by the visual arts, Yoko Ono, Doris Salcedo. I'm inspired to encourage engagement with our futures. I'm not sure how much more of this I can take. She needs a better scriptwriter or to learn how to speak humanoid English.
Ida's Cornish residency will coincide with the looming G7 Leaders Summit at nearby Carbis Bay. Meller reckons it is possible that the likes of Boris, Biden, Merkel and Macron will visit the studio. If so, fingers crossed, they'll get harangued by a robot. She tells me she's an admirer of cautionary thinkers like Huxley and Orwell, and worries that we're sleepwalking into a combination of Brave New World and 1984.
Are you okay with a world like this? I'm not sure I like this, she says.
Questions remain. What does it mean for a machine to like anything? Why does Ida love to see the world grow? If we are already on the superhighway to transhumanism, should we enjoy the ride, as Elon Musk suggests, or hit reverse? And there is another question. Is Ida going to become as successful as a millionaire fellow postmodernist artists like Jeff Koons and Damien Hirst? Mella says her self-portraits are not for sale. That said, Ida is already a lucrative proposition. When her drawings were exhibited in Oxford in 2019, Mella told reporters that already £1 million worth of her work had been sold. Quite an achievement, given that, at the time, she had only been active for 2 months. She's a prodigy, and thanks to her evolutionary algorithms, is steadily learning how to become a painter, a better artist. It can only be a matter of time before Ida wins the Turner Prize.
That was Stuart Jeffries. And now we have Boris Johnson reading out that letter I mentioned at the beginning. This was a complaints letter that was drafted by Carrie Simmons and Boris Johnson after the Times ran an article about their dog Dylan being so annoying that they considered giving him up for adoption. Here's what it said.
Dear Sir, we write further to an article on the 11th of March 2020 entitled Dylan the Downing Street Dog to be reshuffled. This article is based on a wholly false premise and contains a number of highly inaccurate claims published in spite of categorical on-the-record denials by Downing Street. To be absolutely clear, it is completely false to allege that Dylan will be rehoused now or at any point in the future. Furthermore, it is also totally untrue to suggest that he suffers from chronic ill health. Dylan is, and always will be, a much-loved member of our family. He is a happy and healthy dog, and making a claim to the contrary is entirely without foundation. The article also makes a number of highly inaccurate, damaging allegations about our home and private life. These are not only false, but a gross invasion of our privacy. Despite our complaint, the paper has refused to publish a suitable apology and correction. The article is extremely upsetting and hurtful, particularly given our well-documented commitment to animal welfare. As a result of publication of the article, we have received and continue to receive abuse from concerned members of the public, misled into believing that we would callously rehome our much-loved family dog. It is hugely disappointing that you have failed to take responsibility for the damage that you have caused by publishing these untrue and unwarranted claims. We have been offered the opportunity to have a letter published outlining our position. This is inadequate and unacceptable. Despite our best efforts towards amicable resolution, we have no option but to pursue the matter formally with IPSO, the Independent Press Standards Organisation, for full and proper recourse. The article is in breach of the editor's code of practice in terms of Clause 1, accuracy, Clause 2, privacy, Clause 3, harassment, and Clause 6, children. We look forward to hearing from you as a matter of urgency. Yours sincerely, Boris and Carrie. How was that? Was that okay? Do you need me to rewrite it? Well, I mean, I'm not going to write it. I'll get someone else to. So was that okay? Great.